see where we go.
Okay. Well, I guess let's go back a little bit to your history. When did you first run for school board?
School board? I believe it's late 90s, 98, 99. I had completed a two-year study with the Wisconsin Rural Leadership Program, and that had exposed you to lots of different policy, public policy roles in state and federal government relative to transportation, education, government regulation, wetlands. I mean, it was a two-year program that basically we got together every 8-9 weeks for about 5 days. And it was just a very great explorative thing. They put that group of people together by, I think, hand-picking them. They purposely had people that were far right, far left, centrist, blatant Republicans, blatant Democrats, blatant independents, all walks of life. It was called the Rural Leadership Program, but probably most everybody came from either a small community. A number of us were farmers, but it was small cities, small communities, villages, and there were a few people from the cities. So we had a great diverse group of people that would meet, and while the subjects were very insightful, I think the challenging discussions that we had privately at night were probably the most rewarding, because I was trying to figure out your perspective and you were trying to figure out my perspective and why I saw it that way, or why you saw it that way, I saw it this way. I mean, when we had most of those seminars were in the state of Wisconsin. We had a couple that were out of the state. We had one up in northwestern United States in the Columbia River area. We had one in Washington, D.C., and we had an international program. The outgrowth of that was to become more involved. I was definitely had a different perspective. A couple of the earlier program participants had become representatives. One was a senator, one was an assemblyman that I was aware of. And my daughter had reached age of going to school, and my school didn't offer all-day kindergarten, and we felt she should be in all-day kindergarten, and motivated me to run. And we had used school choice to put my daughter in a full-day kindergarten program, and we did the same thing with my son, and that irritated some of my fellow board members on the school board why my children were no longer in the school district, even though I was on the board. And we had finally gotten five-year-old kindergarten in place. And I said, well, that's illustrative of the risk that we share when we don't offer maybe the programming that parents want. They can take their children publicly someplace, and then they find a school they like, and it's like, then they have to decide when they change that location. We did eventually bring them back into the Fort School District, but they stayed a little bit longer in the building we had them in, because we liked the staff and our children liked it, and so we made the extra effort for that time period. But, you know, it was just it's a matter of giving back to the public. In my youth, I couldn't have imagined myself having done that. There was probably a time period when I was courting my spouse that we had a great discussion over whether family and size of family, or if there'd be family. If you can imagine young people growing up not necessarily liking the parenting that they're receiving, and you know, your parents go from being maniacal overlords to gifted with wisdom as you go from 15 to 30. And you go from not understanding them to loving them for everything they gave you, even when at the time they were giving it to you, you didn't think it was enough.
So when you were on the school board, you got on for reasons, you know, for a lot of people, personal reasons, and to see some change. When did you start to understand the financing system and some of the challenges that it presented?
Well, budgeting is always an issue. It wasn't uncommon from the get-go that you had to work with revenue caps, because they were in place for some 5-6 years before I got on board. And it was always interesting to, you know, listen to the business manager make his presentation, and he would talk about, Fort Atkinson was in this tertiary aid situation at the time. And depending upon where we went with our spending level, we could either be penalized or ingratiated because of the tertiary aid. So if you were spending a little bit too much, you might get you might lose some of your funding that you were otherwise eligible for. So it was kind of a balancing game. It was also a challenge to go through the negotiation process with staff, and it was very challenging when you understand that this is about what we can do. I think at that time the revenue cap was still allowing it to grow with inflation, and so if you knew that inflation was 2% or 5%, you knew you weren't going to be able to work much different than that, and so you had to work within that. And there was a time period years ago where unions were getting monumental benefits relative to negotiations because they didn't seem to cost much. Healthcare didn't cost much, and you could offer healthcare. You could offer outstanding healthcare. And that was starting to change. Healthcare was starting to ramp up its premium charge. There were some other costs that were starting to increase along with healthcare, but retirement benefits. Not everybody was putting in what they needed to be putting in to properly fund that retirement. Well, long term, that's an issue. I mean, that's part of the problem of what this legislature dealt with the city of Milwaukee this biennial session, was some, I'll call it some misplanning or mismanagement of their retirement system and the numbers they were using to project whether or not they were saving enough or putting enough aside for the commitments they had made to their future retirees. So I enjoy numbers. It wasn't uncommon for me to get into that minutia, and when someone would consider a 1% change, I could, okay, so that's about $500,000 in budget. Yeah. And the manager would agree to that. Yeah, that's about right. And so I could understand those. So it was, you wanted to do things, but you wanted to do a very balanced assessment. And is that really the best place to invest that next piece of improvement, say, to that educational system? And if it was, well, then that's fine. But you have to convince the other board members that that may be the place to do it too, because not everybody necessarily sees it that way. The 5K programming was a motivator to get on the board. The first time we brought that out, we still had to retain a couple sections of what we'll call half-day 5K program because there were parents that didn't want to give their children up. They wanted their children at home. And so we offered that. And I don't think it lasted but 1 year. Maybe we had a section left in the second year. But while the parents were just, they were up in arms to a degree that we were going the full day, it didn't take very long for them to recognize the educational benefit that their children got out of the all-day 5K. So that was the start of it. It was just, you would go into negotiation and you could have the best plan and say, well, here's what we're going to get. We're going to get a 4% increase. And if we do this 4% increase, here's our cost of operating in our buildings, yada, yada, yada. This is what we can offer. And you make that offer. And you get it soundly rejected in like a half hour. And you're like, wow, that was well received. They want more. No, we can't give it. It isn't available. And then that dance would take place over the next 8-9 months. And you'd spend a lot of time in committees, meetings, negotiating. And you'd go round and round and round. And about the time it was time for the contract to be signed, when there was no, you know, the drop dead date, and lo and behold, we'd almost be back right where we started. A few changes, a few nuances, perhaps. But it was disappointing that we had to go through that dance process, knowing ultimately we're going to end up in the same place.
So if we flash forward to today, how well do you think most of your colleagues understand school financing from the inside point of view, not just the state budget, but from having served and observing a local budget?
You're speaking of my colleagues here in this building.
Yes.
Many do not understand it. It's a convoluted, challenging system, because one of my disappointments on the school board was, of all the regulatory mandates that are out there that you have to comply with, you could come up with a good idea and then be informed that, oh no, we can't do that because we got to do this instead. We've got so much time committed to this. We got so many dollars committed to that. Nope, that's not going to work. That's in conflict with some other rule or regulation. I don't know that there's many in this building that have served extensively on a school board. There are those that have. Don't get me wrong. I think there's a number of members that have served on school boards. Whether or not they got involved in the detail of budget development, do not know, because every district is different. And I think the level of commitment that a school board member might make to understanding that can be quite varied as well. Your question was, how many understand it? And I would say few. And because it's so challenging and so convoluted, it's tough to communicate that to the public, because you got this pot coming here for that, you got this pot coming from there to this, we got this regular, and then, oh yeah, that's what's coming from the state, and then you're allowed so much from your local taxpayer, it's just a very challenging thing to put together. And the public sees their property tax bill, and you can affect the mill rate. You can lower the mill rate, and your tax bill still goes up. And they're like, how can that be? Well, their assessments changed. It's just a very challenging way of communicating. It's far easier to sell the message, vote no, don't increase taxes. Well, it's a simple message. And if I don't want my tax bill to go up, voting no seems to be a simple way of controlling my tax. What the vote no doesn't tell you is, you're going to lose this, you're going to lose that, you're going to lose this, you're going to lose that. Those are what you're going to lose. And you don't tell the public in advance of what the reductions are going to be, because that's basically then cannibalizing your own system, because those who are on the chopping block know they're on the chopping block, and those who are safe have no concern because you've already identified them. So it's just if school funding was just X amount per child, period. Doesn't matter what it's spent on, where it's going, what it's doing. Okay, it's coming from GPR funds, and it's $20,000 a child. So be it. Done. It's not that simple.
Can you wake your computer up again?
You want me to wake that up?
Yep, just so we can get that. So it can be the same as it's looked through the rest of the interview.
Okay, so you want me to do that?
If you can get back on that page that it was on, that calendar it looked like.
Mm-hmm. Ah, I know what I did wrong. Let's try it now.
So, when you see what happened in Fort Atkinson the last few times they tried to pass a referendum, what happened there? What, in your opinion, what was the message from the school about the need, and what was the answer from the public about their ability to pay?
I don't think a vote yes or no has much. People might think it has to do with their ability to pay. I think it's willingness. But and there are people that tax bill is monumental. I think of seniors with fixed incomes or whatever, reduced incomes from what they had when they were in their working years. Defeat that took place might have been a couple fold. One was, for the first time, I think the community had two referendums on the ballot. One was for fire and EMS, and one was for the school district. And they were both what I'll call fairly significant endeavors. And I think the public, it just psychologically said, I can't afford both. I've given the school a bunch in the past. We're going to do fire and EMS this time. I think that's one way of looking at that. They made a choice. They'd fund one referendum, but not the other. I also think that in today's media world, we no longer have our local newspaper. We have the Jefferson Daily Union, don't get me wrong, but it's been bought out by APG, and that newsroom in the Hordes building is basically vacant. That used to be filled with staffers for the Daily Union. And the paper doesn't appear to give those local communities near the print that paper used to provide. That's nothing against APG, it's just part of the economics of the world. Same thing happened with our local radio station. There used to be a gentleman there that did a lot of work in keeping the public informed on their local government officials. And that time is no longer dedicated daily, weekly basis for the public to get their information. So there's a challenge to get the message out and communicate that message. And where do you put that message? Where do you, if you go digitally, where do you boost it? And then who's looking for it? Are the seniors on the computer searching you out? Or are the seniors reading what little hard print media they can still get a hold of because that's what they grew up with? So it's challenging to get that message out. And I think that was part of the deal that the administration and the school board had, was the challenge to communicate their message and the value of what they were desiring. And I think between that lack of ability to communicate that message and the competition from a first-time referendum on fire and EMS services was just, it made it a different environment than what they had been exposed to in the past.
So I want to go back to 2001 and when the legislature was passing that particular budget. And at the time, the argument from Robin Voss and Republicans was that there doesn't need to be any more dollars per pupil in funding from the state because of the large amount of ESSER funds coming in from the federal COVID relief acts.
You're talking 2021, not 2000.
So, yes, I apologize. 2021 to 2023.
Okay, because
the budget before
2001, I think, even predates Robin.
Yes, you're right. Okay. I apologize. And they gave a flat increase, or it was no increase to schools for 2 years.
Yeah.
And at the time, the argument from Democrats and school funding advocates was like, this will create a fiscal cliff. We will see it in a couple of years when the ESSER dollars run out. Schools will be in a tough, precarious situation. And this is where we are with the nearly half the school districts in the state have gone to operating referendums since then, and like 80 in April.
I think it's more like 90.
Well, I think 90 is with
some capital.
With some capital.
Okay.
Is it a pretty straight line from the legislature's acts to in that budget to this point, or is it you have to look at the whole arc of school financing to see that?
If you look historically back, we withdrew the indexing, I don't know, 15 years ago or more. And if you were to look at funding from the time we did that till today, there's some $3,000 or more shortfall per student. If all we had done was index the revenue caps as we had during the early 90s, early 2000s. Had we done that, the shortfall now is over $3,000 per student. That's a monumental change. During that same time period, we've also ramped up the dollars that we've siphoned off to take care of the other educational system that we're supporting, which is the private and charter and voucher schools. So there's a double whammy there. Repeat the question.
Is it a straight line from the 2021 budget and to the today's operating referendums that are going around, or is
it a bigger, longer
arc?
No. When we stopped indexing, we basically the outflow of that is we're going to balance local school budgets by referendum, and so basically every school district is facing this cliff every 3-4 years, depending upon how long they run their sunset referendum. And if they never turn any of those sunset referendum into recurring referendum, the cliff just keeps getting higher and higher and higher. And it, when I was on the board, it was not lost on me that if we didn't turn some of those referendum into recurring dollars, we would eventually be asking the public for, on a $30 million budget, for $15 million. And the public's gonna eventually say, well, man, I can cut my property tax bill by $1,000. Vote no. And the devastating impact that has on that local school district is we vacate half the staff because we just whacked the budget. And there is no recall from a failed referendum. You have reductions. You that's what it is. no, it's been building up over time. Had we, and I spoke about the $3,000 shortfall per student today, and it's basically over the last 15 years, 12 years, when this indexing stopped. So we've been given dollars, but they've never kept up with inflation. And so the only alternative that school districts have are to run referendum to make up for the difference. And I'm not certain that the local property tax is where we should be even funding our public education. I know there was a time back years ago, the two-thirds funding. And I'm beginning to wonder if we shouldn't be doing 100% funding of GPR numbers and eliminate the local property tax and fund our education system in the state of Wisconsin from GPR across the board, so that those who are earning income can actually pay for the education system. And those that are on fixed income, we lose seniors every year because they basically get taxed out of their home. And so if we didn't have that recurring unfunded expense adding on to their property tax of their home that they've worked their entire life to pay for, and in retirement they have a reduced income and a fixed income. So you may not think much of increasing property tax 5% a year, or let's say 4% a year. Well, at 4% a year, your property tax is going to double in 18 years. And that's, let's just say in general, that might be the life expectancy after retirement for most everybody. So if your property tax today for school is $2,000, about at the time of your death, it'll be $4,000 at just a 4% growth. That's the rule 72. You take 72 and you divide it by your rate of growth. If it's 12% a year with inflation, it takes it 6 years to double in cost. If it's 6% growth, it takes it 12 years to double. It's just rule 72. It's a simple little formula to kind of see what the growth is. And so if your budget is growing, let's say your $30 million budget's growing 4% a year. Well, in 18 years, your $30 million budget is going to be $60 million to do the same thing you're doing today. Nothing else changes. Nobody's gotten ahead of inflation if inflation's that same rate. If your teaching salaries went from $50,000 to $100,000 during that same 18 years and inflation was 4%, those teachers are no better off in 18 years than what they were today. It's just simple, it's a simple math.
So when you look at the situation that we have with funding right now, the reality is school districts are forced to go to operating referenda.
Absolutely.
You talked about the indexing stopping. Was that part of Act 10, or was that a different Walker-era policy?
I think it happened after Act 10.
Okay.
I think it happened in 11-12.
Okay.
I'm not positive. That predates me a little bit here, and I don't have the memory back on the school board. But the chart that I'm looking at here basically shows it stopping either 9-10, 10-11. But it becomes dramatic in 11-12.
Yeah. So, with the do you think the public understands the fiscal cliff and the inflationary pressure and the state? And it's such a convoluted system. When it comes to them going into the voting booth, they're going to look at a question that's going to ask them to raise their own property taxes. And that's the only thing before them. Do people actually have enough information, do you think, especially given the constraints of where information can come from?
It's really challenging to get into that great discussion in depth because they can't comprehend it. Their eyes will glaze over within a matter of minutes because if you talk to school business managers and ask them to explain it to you, in a half hour you'll be partway into it, okay? And you'll have lost the first 15 minutes of that conversation. You'll just know, oh my God, this is complicated. Why would you go into the business of being a school business manager? And those people that are in it are trying to figure out a way, how can they provide those educational services and still keep the taxpayer, it's a balancing act. Give those people credit because they are doing a service to their community, whether they live in it or not, as much as they can to try to make it work and keep track of those dollars. And people talk about waste and whatnot, and I'm like, well, we've been cutting waste apparently since God created dirt. And we're still cutting waste. And I little doubt in my mind that you can find, oh yeah, I could have done a better expense there, but that was $40 or that was $2,000. It was whatever, you made a choice and something didn't quite go right. But no, it is very challenging for them when they go into the booth to say, I need special ed, I need this. No, they can't see it that way. They basically have to go in the booth probably with their mind already predetermined that they're satisfied that I want my grandchildren, I want my great-grandchildren to have the same type of educational opportunity as I received because I got a good education out of this school. And today we're doing way more than what we did before. But the naysayers might say, oh man, I could save $100. And we shouldn't be doing all this mental health, and we shouldn't be spending this money on school counselors, because whatever the reason might be, we're spending too much money on transportation, or they really didn't need that last security thing that they invested in. We don't have any crime here. We didn't need to put in that safe locked door that cost me $10,000. I mean, it's a door. How can a door cost $10,000? It don't matter what it is or what the cost is. Someone can come up with a simpler story to say no, then you can try to explain factually how convoluted the funding program is. And because it's complicated, we hold annual school board meetings. We used to fund our school budget, our schools, at the annual school board meeting, usually held in July or August. Why are we at referenda? Well, there were taxpayers that didn't like seeing their tax bills going up that complained enough to their representatives, you need to do something about controlling my taxes. Because I show up at the annual meeting and I'm the only one that shows up and I vote no and everybody else says yes and my taxes go up. Was the school board abandoning those taxpayers? No, that school board and that administration did their best due diligence to educate the children that they're charged with by statutory requirement and maybe occasionally do something beyond it. A little thing here, a little thing there. They're not trying to just spend. I mean, we went through the baby boom generation where we were building buildings every other year to keep up with some of these school districts. We have buildings that are now 70 years old, and they're very challenging to maintain. They're very challenging to update with new technology. And so some have knocked down those buildings, and you're knocking down a good building. And now you're asking me to build a $20 million replacement building. And maybe the analysis that's been done because of the new code requires, because of the new regulations that are required of schools, to update the old building costs us $15 million. We can build a brand new building, the right size, with the adequate heating and cooling capacities, more appropriate, what I want to call science labs or whatever it may be, for $5 million more, we get a whole new building that's functional from the get-go with all the technology built into it, instead of making do. It's sort of the experience I had when I promoted geothermal in Fort Atkinson, probably some 20 years ago. We had buildings that we weren't cooling. We had buildings that we couldn't properly heat. We needed to upgrade our systems. And I spent a lot of time and effort studying geothermal. I had been in a building that was heated by geothermal. They were spending a third of the energy, a third of the bill, to heat a building that was twice the size of a building that was heated conventionally. Twice as big a building, spending a third. So it's 1/6, monumental savings. And I did a lot of legwork on it. I had one board member that allowed me to have the time to share my thoughts with the rest of the board, and we eventually upgraded four buildings with geothermal heating and cooling. We had residents that wanted us to only put in heating capabilities. Well, geothermal and the heat pumps have an automatic reversing valve in them. It's just like your refrigerator, except it can also produce heat when you flow the gas the opposite direction. We only need 7 degrees of water temperature differential to pass through that heat pump, and we can either produce heat or we can produce air conditioned air. And all we're doing is circulating water through a group of wells in the earth, through our pipes going through, and then we just branch off into each heat pump. And each heat pump can cover a room or can cover a group of rooms, just a matter of the size of the heat pump. Very efficient. So when you have heat go out in one room, you don't shut down the school building because the boiler went up. You got one room that's cool. And it might not be cool for more than an hour or two while the heating contractor comes out and makes the repair. And it's a refrigeration unit. It's just your little refrigerator you got in your house, except it can also produce heat. It took a lot of effort to get that done. And the community watched that all go in, they watched us bury all these vertical wells in our playgrounds, under our playgrounds. And then we got into solar energy, both from an electrical and a heating water at our swimming pool. I'm not a tree hugger. It was about saving that gas bill. And now I've got a heating, cooling, and a classroom where I don't cook the students in the fall, I don't cook them in the spring, and I don't freeze them out in the winter or boil them because I got one room I can't seem to stop the heat from collecting in.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at the last dozen years and the situation that school districts are in, it's been Republicans who have been in charge of the budget, setting the standard, the minimums of what they're going to allow. Should the public factor in partisanship when it comes to why districts are in this situation? Is it your colleagues and your party that are partly to blame for this, or is that too simplistic when we talk about the totality of this?
Republicans have been in charge of the biennial budgets, and it's pretty clear that most of us Republicans want to favor school choice, voucher schools, charter schools. They do an outstanding job, but the public has to understand now we're now publicly funding both educational systems. And I think that you can lay claim that the private schools do an outstanding job of educating children. But I think you mislead the public if you tell them that our public school system is failing. I don't think our public school system is failing. I think we've overregulated it. I would make the comment that we've almost regulated it to death. I would also say that private schools get the opportunity to choose not only their child, but their child's parents. If you have a child who has parents that are actively involved in their educational career, I don't care where that child goes, they will do good. They will perform well because they have concerned parents that want that child to succeed, and they will help that child to succeed. And I think private schools, voucher schools, charter schools get the advantage of that. I think part of my disappointment with that is we don't have any real accountability of those tax dollars. And I think it's unfortunate that we've sort of shielded the public from the amount of those tax dollars. It's not a big amount when you compare it to public education, but it's still a significant amount. The question goes back to, is the Republicans responsible for the cliffs that we're anticipating? I think and it's a, again, it's a balancing act. I don't know that if we had left it into indexing relative to the revenue caps, there probably wouldn't be referendum. But there would probably be some pretty outspoken cries about high taxes on the property tax bill. I think what the legislature hasn't really come to grips with is whether or not we can properly provide the support to both the private and the public schools, and if we're willing to ask the private schools to give the same accountability that we expect of public schools. I think it's really disingenuous to have all the regulations on one form of education and very minimal regulations on the other. And certainly not necessarily being as accountable to the tax dollars. But I think in a simplistic form, you could draw the correlation that you've stated. We've been in charge of the budgeting process. For the most part, we've restricted budgeting per se, although we had the biggest budgetary allocation in this biennial budget that we've had in years. It really doesn't make us back to where we were, but it's a monumental step forward. But in general, I think it's whether it's the legislature or a particular party, we have basically asked our public schools to balance their budgets by referendum. And so you're going to have a great variation among school districts. If we thought we had disadvantaged school districts when revenue caps went in because of the districts that were so conservative prior to revenue caps underspending, what we're going to get out of referendum budget management is even greater disparity. There are going to be school districts that will be doing the bare minimums across the board, and then you're going to have the high rent districts that will spend almost twice as much, and theoretically we will try to tell the public that those two educational opportunities are the same. And I will suggest to you that that's misleading.
You're not going to see your career advance very far in party politics with some of those statements.
That is correct. And I didn't come here to necessarily do that. I'm plenty old. I have no intention of being here 20 years. I happen to think that if you can't get something done in a few years, you should move on and let someone else try it, because either you or the people you're serving with are unwilling to serve the people.
So, speaking of which, you've got your current old district on the map over there on the wall. How much will the new district be reshaped, and will you be running again?
About half the new district doesn't exist in that picture, or more. Whether or not I'm running again is, I'm likely to. I farm. I'm not going to move my farm. My family farm is located in the 43rd, and that's where I'm going to probably run. I still have to figure that one out with my family. Because there's some things they want to have figured out. We're in retirement, and family would like me to slow down. I'm not motivated that way. My motor is going, and I think my viewpoint is important to my party. And I remember as a youth, both parties had lots of moderates. And those two groups of people could get together, form legislation, and pass it, and we could move forward both at the federal and state level. And today that's pretty well gone. It seems that the two extremes have taken over both parties, both parties have the same problems. It's not just, I'm looking at Democratic maps. Previous, we were looking at Republican maps. We should have passed fair maps, because it's much better if we have a third party drawing these maps than we have either political party drawing them. And my Democratic colleagues suffered amnesia overnight. They campaigned 12 years on fair maps. And like overnight, they suddenly didn't remember that. I can blame my own party for not doing it a year ago, because I think a year ago we could have passed fair maps. We would have had the Democrats on board with us to do it. It's unfortunate for the public, because I think fair maps are critical. I'm big on education. I want to have my roads work. I want to have fair maps. I think fair representation is important. Even with fair maps drawn by a third party, the Republican Party is likely to be in the majority on a routine basis, because that's just the dynamics of the state of Wisconsin. If the public thinks that fair maps is going to have every district be 50-50, that's not going to be it. Because to do that, you would have to gerrymander so bad, you'd have one town wide, 50 miles long, mm-hmm. to get a balanced 50-50 district, because of just how our demographics are located.
So is the 43rd, is that Barb Dietrich?
No. Barb is in the 97th now.
Okay.
She was in the 38th, I believe. Okay. The districts have all changed dramatically.
I know.
The 33rd, which you're looking at on that map, yeah. The 33rd, it is south and east of me. The 33rd contains none of that district anymore. It's got a totally new area.
So then the new district that you are drawn into is the 43rd.
43rd.
And where does that run to? Is that...
Basically, it's the northern... It's the towns of... it's the town of Cold Spring in Jefferson County. It's the town of Whitewater in Richmond in Walworth County. That includes the city of Whitewater, the College of Whitewater. And then going westward, you have the town of Johnstown, the town of Lima, both very rural. And you have the town of Harmony, which includes northeastern, the city of Janesville. And then you have the town of Milton, which includes the city of Milton. Mm-hmm. And then you have the town of Fulton, which includes the city of Edgerton.
Okay. So that's what, Mark Spriker's old district, kind of?
Well, it's parts of Mark.
Okay.
Okay. Mark is a senator now from yeah. Beloit. So he would cover 43rd. So it must be the 43rd, 4th, and 6th. No, it can't be that, 43rd. Anyway, I'm trying to remember. He'll still be the senator. Sue Connolly is retiring.
Yep.
Clint Anderson, I think, is the assemblyman that covers part of Beloit with Mark. And Mark, that Senate seat now is like western, north and western Rock County. And then it comes up, I think it wraps around and goes up into Dane County a little bit. I don't have those three maps just fully in my mind yet. But those three seats are all blatantly Democratic leaning. Mm-hmm. It will be unexpected of me to survive that election because of the way the map is drawn and, mm-hmm. and the population, the way it currently votes.
But that's where your family farm is located, yep. So that's where you'll yep. stay. Okay. All right. Do you have anything that you want to add along the lines of what we've been talking about here?
What time is it?
It is 10 after 2.
Okay. So while you're still rolling here, time-wise, how long do you want to spend? It takes about an hour to get to Jefferson.
Okay.
Okay. If we want to go to Jefferson, what time do you want to be in Fort?
The meeting starts at 5:30. They said members are getting there around 5. So, yeah, if we...
Get there by 5?
Yeah.
Okay. because the earliest any buses are going to be back in Jefferson is basically 4 o'clock.
Okay.
All right. And all the buses should be pretty well back in Jefferson by 4:30. So we could have our pick of the lot at that point in time. So relative to what else I want to add, I don't know that I have anything in particular I want to add, but I'll invite you to ride with me to Jefferson and we can have more conversation if you're willing to do that.
Sure.
I don't need you to be videotaping me or whatnot, but I think you would learn more about me as a person and a candidate that you might find either boring or irritating. I don't know which, maybe enjoyable. That might be the long shot. But I didn't come here because I thought I was God's gift. I came here because I wanted to truly try to help my state, my party, try to get a little different attitude about where we're at. What I've learned is much more challenging. There are other people in this building that are like-minded. We just haven't figured out how to speak and be heard, maybe, or we certainly don't outnumber those on the far right. And it doesn't mean that they're wrong, it's just that's their perspective. I just think that we can do a lot more for this state working from the middle than we can from the edges. There's lots of issues that we can address, we can do much better on than what we are, and we just simply, I think from a political landscape, are unwilling to address those because I think you made the comment relative to just recently about me not having a very long political career because of some of my beliefs. And that may be absolutely correct. Doesn't mean that attempting to do that for the public is wrong. It just, that might be the reality of where the political winds are blowing. I think it's unfortunate because I think it's important for us to represent the people and not a particular ideology. The district I ran in, that 33rd, a very balanced district. It was almost a 50-50 district. I think it was a 51-49, 52-48. The gentleman I ran against was probably very similar to me, Don Verink, mm-hmm. an extremely well-liked person. He had voted at times or probably did things in his party like I'm doing in mine, which doesn't endear you necessarily to leadership. I think if this legislative body was filled with people that were more moderate in sense, I think we'd find far better solutions than what we currently are. I think many of the solutions that we're finding now are very one-sided, and I don't know that that's necessarily right. And depending upon how much of this you share, I may get a whole lot more unwelcome feedback. And yet I think it's a message somehow some people need to receive. You asked me to be comfortable. You asked me to have a conversation with you. And I think we've done that. I think you've also found out that you probably only asked about a third of the questions you wanted to ask.
No, I got everything I needed.
Yeah. So I speak too freely, too self-motivated.
It's well, speaking freely is not a rare thing in a politician, but actually turning around to answer the question is, so I appreciate that.
Okay. Well,
so I think we'll wrap these and let Brandon start tearing down.
Yep.